On Tech News Today, a software flaw called Heartbleed could expose your web traffic, even if it's encrypted. Comcast says it's an underdog surrounded by strong competitors like Apple, Google, and Facebook, and should be allowed to buy Time Warner Cable. And the FTC says people behind the social site Jerk.com are, well, a bunch of jerks. All that and more coming up next.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Today for Tuesday, April 8th, 2014. This episode of Tech News Today is brought to you by ShareFile. Enhance your workflow, send files of almost any size easily and securely with ShareFile by Citrix. Try ShareFile today for a 30-day free trial. Go to ShareFile.com, click the microphone, and enter TNT. And by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. For a free two-week trial and 10% off, go to Squarespace.com and use the offer code TNT. Welcome to Tech News Today. I'm Mike Elgin.
And I'm Jason Howell.
Tech News Today explores the big stories of the day in conversation with some of the world's best journalists. Our guest co-anchor this week is Natalie Morris, a contributor to The Today Show and CNBC. Welcome, Natalie.
Welcome back. Thank you.
Well, can you feel it?
Welcome back to my house is what I meant.
Well, thank you. Thank you for inviting us all 50,000 or whatever, to your house. It's very hospitable of you. Now, can you feel the apocalypse? Today is the end of support for Windows XP, and the sky is falling. It's going to be a disaster. In other words, nothing is going to happen. And this is something that I learned from our first interview guest. So we'll get to him in just a second. But I was a little concerned yesterday. I was in the dentist chair and I looked up and my dentist is using Windows XP.
But on your dental
machines? Yeah, they have a big screen where they put the pictures to show you your teeth so that they can charge you more, because it looks horrible when your teeth are gigantic.
So. Oh, yeah, definitely. But then do those tools run through that program, or the tools run independently on just an outlet, right?
Yeah, I think they just use it for the patient information and all that stuff.
Right. They're not, I wouldn't care so much about that. Like, okay, maybe you lose my history, but you can't have my dental tools routed through Windows XP. That's not okay.
Well, as long as they're not surfing porn sites, I think
you have a driver problem. In terms of end of life. Oh, there's something wrong with this driver for the drill bit. So sorry about that. I accidentally sliced off a tooth.
I hate that.
Yeah.
Let's get into the news. A widely distributed flaw in OpenSSL card called Heartbleed potentially exposes millions of users to being monitored as they interact with websites. Joining us to explain it all is Steve Gibson, a security researcher, founder of Gibson Research Corporation, and co-host of Twit's Security Now. Welcome, Steve.
Hey, guys. Great to be with you. Sort of.
Thank you so much.
on this disturbing day.
Yes, it's
ominous.
It's very disturbing. And just to be clear, it's not because of Windows XP. Everything I know about not worrying about Windows XP's end of life, I learned from you, Steve. So thank you for those reassurances. And now you can panic and terrify us all by telling us all about this OpenSSL problem and Heartbleed. So what is, first of all, before we get into Heartbleed, can you first explain what OpenSSL is and how widely it's deployed?
So OpenSSL is the predominant, like by a huge factor, solution for web servers and instant messaging clients and anything that wants to use the SSL protocol on the internet in the open source world. So, for example, we have Microsoft and their server, which is not OpenSSL, and everything else, which is.
Yeah.
So, you know, all of the Apache servers almost exclusively use OpenSSL. There is an alternative package which has very low adoption. OpenSSL is pretty much the de facto standard. All of the Linux systems use it. I mean, it's the way you establish a secure communication using, you know, the HTTPS that we're familiar with for protecting login credentials when you sign into a website.
Well, and then what is Heartbleed, and has it been exploited at all?
Well, the problem, okay, so what happened is that 2 years ago, there was an addition made, and a so-called extension to the long-running TLS protocol. TLS is what is sort of what replaced SSL. SSL went up to version 3.0, then TLS 1.0, 1.1, and 1.2 is where we are today. So 2 years ago, an extension was added to add what's called a heartbeat to the TLS protocol. The heartbeat is something which just sends some data back and forth between the endpoints, typically, you know, the user's browser and the server, to keep the connection alive. There are many things now, for example, home routers, which create a dynamic connection through themselves out to the internet. But after a while, they'll tear that connection down. They'll sort of forget about you unless you keep using it. So this heartbeat was a means of allowing the TLS protocol to keep those connections open. And unfortunately, the individual, and we know his name, he's in the open source code taking credit for submitting this change. Essentially, a month before an RFC was finalized to establish this heartbeat protocol, it was added to OpenSSL almost exactly 2 years ago. I think it was March in 2012. And that created OpenSSL version 1.0.1. And all versions since then, so for the last 2 years, have had the feature of this heartbeat, and when it's enabled, it allows for this exploitation. Essentially, the worst of what this means is that an attacker can reach into a web server and obtain its prized SSL certificate, which is the thing it more than anything else wants to keep secret, because that's the way it proves its identity on the internet.
So now this has been fixed, right? Yesterday, as I understand it, in a 1.0.1G release. Is that correct?
Correct. From 1.0.1 through F, the predecessor to G, all of these had the problem. It was fixed yesterday. So in terms of remediation, here's what has to happen. Any website that was using 1.0.1 through 1.0.1F, that is for the past 2 years, essentially any site that upgraded to the latest OpenSSL and enabled this feature, it can be enabled or disabled by recompiling OpenSSL. So not all sites may have had it turned on. If it was turned on, their certificate was vulnerable. We don't know that it was taken. There's no trace left after this attack. So it is, there's nothing left in logs. There's no way for a server to know whether anyone exfiltrated their security certificate. So they have to assume it could have happened. Mm-hmm. That means mm-hmm. that the current certificate has to be revoked so that if the certificate was stolen, which essentially is their identity, it cannot be then used, and they have to have a new certificate reissued, which, you know, would be from April 8th of 2014 or afterwards.
Now, so, what does this mean for the user then? Because we can't go around demanding that every website that we go to has this patch. How can we verify that?
Yeah, I mean, we're in a bit of a quandary. For example, responsible companies immediately stepped up. LastPass has a blog out where they explained that even though they were using the vulnerable OpenSSL, because their technology that they themselves use is, as you know, I use the acronym on the podcast, TNO, Trust No One, the data they're holding for their clients is encrypted in the browser. They never have the keys. So the risk for them was minimal, But despite that, they immediately changed the certificate, reissued, and put out a blog post to explain the nature of the vulnerability and what the problem was. Really, we need to see that across the industry. We need a response from websites to, you know, what their impact was. There is a very good online test now. The guy, Ivan Ristic at SSLLabs.com, worked all night. He and I have been corresponding since this happened yesterday, and he has now added a test for this to the SSLLabs.com site. So you can go to SSLLabs.com, say you want to check your server, put in the domain name of anyone else's site that you wish, and in the report that comes up, Ivan has now added a specific explanation of whether or not this site is currently vulnerable to the OpenSSL problem. So that doesn't tell us anything, unfortunately, about the past.
So Steve, I just want to characterize this so people can digest this news and this information and be able to understand and contextualize it. We hear security stories every single day. This is vulnerable. That's vulnerable. Most of these things are reported and don't affect anyone. They take place only in obscure circumstances. This seems to me, and I'd like you to confirm or correct what I'm saying. This seems to me to be a gigantic security flaw, potentially affecting millions, hundreds of millions of people, and because it's been around for so long, and because it goes after the very guts of the security of websites. Is that a fair way or an accurate way for people to think of this flaw?
I would add only one thing to that. First of all, it is true. I believe your teeth and your dentist are just fine because they're not, you know, your dentist using XP, for example, in an embedded environment as a viewer of X-rays isn't causing any problem. The reason for the OpenSSL concern is, and what I would add to what you said, is there is nothing worse than a vulnerability in a fundamental internet protocol, which by nature is exposed to the internet. So every web server that was using OpenSSL had updated during this two-year window or isn't yet updated. That's even worse now because everybody knows about this. There's already code for checking for this and verifying it over on GitHub. So this is no mystery how to do this. Web servers have to respond instantly or they risk exposing, like now that the knowledge is common, their most prized credentials.
Yeah, that's a great point, Steve. And I want to thank you so much for coming on this morning and explaining this very complex and very huge news to us.
And CNET actually is reporting that some Yahoo passwords were already revealed. So it looks like, I can't tell from just reading the first few paragraphs if it were anyone malicious that revealed it or if it was within the test that the SSL people did. Do you know?
What we do know is that the guys who discovered this tested this on themselves, and they found their own certificate and passwords that were crucial private information that their own server never wanted to have revealed. So they have verified that there is this vulnerability. So that may be what CNET's talking about, or it may already be out in the wild.
All right, okay. Steve, well, I want to thank you for coming on, and I really appreciate your time this morning.
My pleasure, guys. Thanks.
All right, you can find Steve at grc.com and also on Twitter at sggrc. And I also recommend that everybody, even if you don't think you're interested or have the background to understand Security Now, which is Steve's show that he co-hosts with Leo Laporte, you really should listen to it. It's very entertaining. Even if you're not super knowledgeable about security, it's a great show, and it's probably the most relevant show out there on security. Well, definitely the most relevant on security, but I really enjoy it, and so I recommend that everybody listen.
And today's topic is Heartbleed. It's what we'll be talking about in much greater depth, so anyone who's interested can find more this afternoon.
Yeah, excellent, excellent. I will be listening to it myself, so I appreciate that. Thanks, Steve.
Thanks, guys.
Well, an Indian startup called Innata Systems has developed a chip for wearable computers that can run for 30 days in full on mode without recharging. The company emerged from stealth mode today, and they've got some big backers, including Samsung and Qualcomm. With us to explain this story is Don Clark, technology writer for The Wall Street Journal. Welcome, Don.
Hello.
I've been reading you, Don, by the way, for so long, for many, many years, and I really appreciate you coming on at last on Tech News Today. So I'm looking forward to hearing your information on this. So now, can you tell us about Innata Systems? Where did this company come from?
It's been operating in stealth mode for a couple of years in India. The people who are there are people who had built operations largely for AMD in India, some of which are now part of Qualcomm. And these guys are real veteran tech semi guys. And they decided that basically every new wave of technology has kind of had its own chip, kind of chip architecture. PCs had their own chips. Mobile devices have had their own chips. They decided that wearables just had their own attributes, largely related to power consumption, that meant that they really need to start from scratch almost in designing them.
Now, one of the things that's of note when you talk about wearables is people mean different things when they say wearables. Sometimes it's a Google Glass type device. Even within the Google Glass or even within the smart glass world, there are super high power and super low power devices. People think of wristwatches. Google mentioned a smart jacket. You know, they, it could be anything. And what's interesting about this news is that this chipset line, I guess you would call it, called the Danush, will come in four tiers. So it'll they actually have four tiers to run the gamut of the wearable potential wearable devices. Is that correct?
That's right. And within the chip architecture, it also has different levels in each kind of chip. So we're used to these big processors that have a major CPU or a major graphics chip. This has is basically the key to its operation is a very small, very quiet chip that is essentially the always-on part of the chip. And it basically listens to sensors and just basically listens to see if it should wake up and wake up the rest of the circuitry. So when it's in that mode, it draws very, very little power. So that's a key thing with say a smartwatch or something in your on your clothing or something. You don't want to be plugging it in all the time. And so they've basically started with it with a pretty much a clean sheet of paper. Then they within their product family, they go everywhere from a kind of a full, you know, kind of Android style computing processor to a much, much simpler kind of product for a simpler kind of wearable device.
And don't you wonder how long then it will take to charge something like this? If it's going to last for 30 days, it won't take 30 days to then charge back up, right? That'd be stupid.
That's right. One of the things that you forget about is that the physical size of the batteries just keep getting smaller and along with the physical size of the devices. The actual amount of space you have for the battery is also gone way down. That's the other issue with when you have something the size of a wristwatch or something smaller. So it won't take a super long time to charge because it can't store very much. So that's not really the problem. Problem is draining it as slowly as possible.
Now, Don, do you think the story and the emergence of this company and the nature of their technology indicates a new era for Indian technology? I mean, people in the United States sometimes think of India as specializing in call centers and things like that. Think about China as specializing in manufacturing. But here they're kind of positioning themselves as the Intel for the wearable era. Is this part of a larger evolution of the technology scene in India, do you think?
Well, I'm not an expert on the technology scene there, but my understanding is they've always had a very big force of programmers. So they do a lot of software work, but they have also churned out a lot of electrical engineers that have gone on to the semiconductor industry, mostly outside of India. There has been some work inside of India that has been, operations of Intel, of Qualcomm, of AMD, based there. And they do projects kind of ordered up by the home office. I think what's exciting about this is a more entrepreneurial streak of products actually conceived and designed within the country. So admittedly, there aren't many companies of that ilk in India. So it's hard to say that this will be the one that redefines the landscape, but it's certainly a different kind of attempt than the usual Indian startup.
Well, companies like this tend to breed other companies. If you look at the history of Silicon Valley, it's, you know, Fairchild Semiconductor engineers leave to form Intel, and then engineers from them there leave to form other companies, and eventually you get Silicon Valley. And of course, these engineers left from Western and U.S. companies for the most part. And so, yeah, so this could be actually kind of a seed for a new sort of chip design, conceptualization, and fabrication industry within India, which would be a really interesting turn of events. They certainly got the engineers and the will to do it. So it's pretty exciting news for people who are rooting for India to continue to emerge as a closer to a first world economy. Don, I want to
Or even anyone who wants to then argue for immigration reform, because, you know, the argument there is that we train a lot of engineers over here and then send them right back because our immigration policy is so wonky. If you want to get all political about it.
Agreed.
And of course, I always do. So, Don, do you think that, did you have a comment about?
Wanted to say one thing is, one of the things that's interesting is any kind of chip startup has had trouble getting funding these days. For the past, 7 or 8 years, venture capitalists in Silicon Valley, they want to put money into something that they can get a profit return on after they put in $5 or $10 million. Chip startups take usually 60 or 70 million before you get anything out of them. So it's been strange to fund any chip startup. So this company managed to get 17 million. Qualcomm and Samsung are involved. Imagination Technologies, the British graphics chip maker, is also one of the first investors. And they really got some great board members. The chairman is Sanjay Yha, who was at ran Motorola Mobility, was a long time at Qualcomm, and is now the CEO of Global Foundries. So he is, they've got some heavyweight people on their board.
Right. So funny about this is that this market is so bullish when there are still reports saying that the majority, a large percentage of people get these wearables and then abandon them within 6 weeks, 6 months. But, the industry is saying, no, you want this, believe me.
Exactly. And it's part of the whole Internet of Things concept, which is really, if you make a watch, if you don't make it a smart watch, pretty soon you won't be in the watch business. If you make a lighting fixture, and if it's not a smart lighting fixture, pretty soon you won't be able to sell a lighting fixture or a doorknob if it's not smart. So I really think people are betting that just intelligence is going to become just the price of entry for a lot of conventional businesses.
Yeah, which is going to make dumb watches a luxury item for the wealthy, I guarantee it. Well, Don, I want to thank you for coming on Tech News today. Again, I'm a big fan and hope to have you on again soon.
Cheers. Thank you.
All right. You can find Don at WSJ.com, of course, and also on Twitter at DonAL888. Well, in a sec, we're going to tell you what's new with Comcast. They made their big case for why they should be allowed to buy Time Warner Cable. But first, I want to tell you about ShareFile. The interesting thing about today's security story with Heartbleed is that this security vulnerability existed for 2 years before you heard about it. And that's the nature of security problems, which is that you find out about them when it's too late. So don't take any chances with files that you share with other people. The worst thing you can do is simply attach a file to email and send it off into the open internet. That is a recipe for disaster. The right way to send files is to use ShareFile.com, which is one of our sponsors today. What ShareFile does is you upload your file to their secure servers, and then you send a link. That link will get past the corporate firewalls that filter out attachments of too big a size, or some even filter out all attachments, and it will enable the user to simply click on the link and download the file securely. When that happens, if you choose, you can be notified that that file has been downloaded. You can even determine how many times the file gets to be downloaded, and again, you'll know exactly who's doing what with that file, which is a fantastic thing. I shared this information with my wife. She shared it with our accountant, and now he's sharing it with all of his other clients. It's especially great for secure things like financial records and documents of that nature. It's also great for gigantic files of hundreds of megabytes, multiple gigabytes. ShareFile can handle those all very easily. But even if you're sending files that are not secure and not ginormous, you should use ShareFile anyway, because it's just a great way to share files very securely and conveniently, and you'll always have total awareness about what's happening with the file you're sharing. So sign up today for our 30-day free trial, no obligation. Go to sharefile.com, click the microphone at the top of the homepage, and enter TNT. And remember that, sharefile.com, type in TNT. Well, Comcast made its case today for why regulators should let the company buy Time Warner Cable in a $45 billion transaction. Comcast's 180-day, 80-page filing to regulators today said that Time Warner Cable is not a competitor, but Apple, Google, and Facebook are competitors. Now, Jason, do we have Peter Kafka? So we don't have Peter today. So this is a really interesting case because Comcast, which is obviously a dominant player, spent 180 pages essentially saying, "Hey, we're just little old Comcast. We're not that scary. We have all these scary people, companies like Google and Apple." And by the way, they had some language in their filing which made people indicate that they have some inside information about an Apple box that Apple is supposedly working on. I don't think that the information in their filing is all that revealing. They're probably just reading the same stuff the rest of us are.
Right. But speculation serves for a really good data point.
Exactly. There was no smoking gun or any sort of inside information in the document about Apple. So Natalie, this is an interesting case they're making, and they do have a certain amount of a good point. Basically, the broadband services and the nature of Comcast business is that each market is distinct from the other markets. For example, if they dominate one market in some city in Texas, that doesn't mean they dominate some other city in Idaho. And what they're saying is that for the most part, Time Warner Cable, which they want to acquire, dominates other markets than Comcast, and therefore by merging the two companies, they're not essential. It's not the same thing as, you know, McDonald's buying Burger King, because both of those companies are global.
Right. If you give them a pass for benevolence, you can see their argument here. Where they're strong, we're weak. Where we're weak, they're strong. I don't know if I said that right.
Exactly.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
That's why any company merges. But, you know, those of us who operate in the real world know that these are two very big companies. They're saying, you know, together we're better, and it's still going to increase competition. But I, you know, the whole argument here is that competitors don't feel that way. So it's going to be up to the government to decide, you know, bit by bit, if that's true. That's why it takes 180 pages to prove that, because on the grand scale of things, when you take the top-down view, it feels very uncomfortable.
So I'm going to give you a little taste of this report. And this was summarized in a blog post by Comcast Executive Vice President David Cohen. And I'm going to quote from his blog post to tell you what Comcast is saying about how big and scary their competition is. So here's the quote. Netflix has over 33 million customers in the United States alone, with another 11 million international customers. Google's video websites now attract over 157 million unique viewers each month, who watch nearly 13 billion videos. And Apple iTunes viewers purchase over 800,000 TV episodes and over 350,000 movies every day. Those are some big, scary numbers. The problem is that in order for all this to happen, you have to have an internet connection to your house. And chances are, if you live in the United States, that's likely to be Comcast. So Comcast, you know, the average consumer has the choice between one, two, or three potential providers of internet connectivity. And that's not a whole lot of choice. So Comcast, in fact, does have quite a kind of, not a stranglehold, but once they do acquire Time Warner Cable, it might be characterized as a stranglehold, totally dominant position in that last mile connecting people to the internet. So all of this stuff about all the competition that they have from the internet, that all comes through Comcast for customers of Comcast. So that's kind of a weak argument. And I think that this will pass simply because, you know, mergers like this tend to, and there has to be really good reasons to not
I'm going to take a much more pessimistic view. I think this will pass because Comcast has a lot of money in lobbyists in Washington.
That's true as well. So, and of course, you really get a flavor of that on Netflix's House of Cards, which you have to get through Comcast. So
maybe Netflix is trying to make a point here, because Netflix has been very vocal about how they do not like dealing with Comcast.
That's exactly right. Well, the FTC says a Massachusetts-based website called Jerk.com and its owner, Napster co-founder John Fanning, deceived more than 73 million users by harvesting personal information from their Facebook profiles. In other words, the FTC is saying that the people behind Jerk.com are a bunch of jerks. Yeah, it sounds like it. If the accusations are correct, essentially what they did, according to the FTC, is that Jerk.com was a social site that would tell people that other people are judging you and saying that you're a jerk, and we're harvesting all this other information that other people have uploaded. In fact, they got most of that information, according to the FTC, from Facebook, from people's own Facebook profiles, which when you sign up for jerk.com, you give them your Facebook information. And then they would download your own information and then present it as information that other people were saying about you. And then for only $30, you could correct your online profile and you would no longer be seen as a jerk by your friends. This is a weird case. And if the accusations are correct, and I'm not super familiar with jerk.com. I haven't used it myself, but if the accusations are correct, then I hope that the FTC does something about it, because it sounds like a pretty shady business. What do you think, Natalie?
Yeah, it's so weird. It's so hard to understand. Like, you're trying to prevent other people's image of you, which, whether that's online or in real life, is a zero-sum game.
Yeah, it sounds like they're trying to prey on the insecurities of people and sort of manipulate people and with falsehood, right, and so on. But again, there could be another side to this story. We tried to get people from jerk.coms, but they were a bunch of jerks and didn't reply. I'm just kidding.
You know how we see all these reports that come out that say Facebook makes you unhappy?
Yes.
This is right. Further proof of that.
That's right.
You're so worried about your public persona that you're really going to pay $30 to make sure that other people like you.
Yeah, losing $30 makes me unhappy too, so there's no win situation. Well, mm-hmm. Six major Hollywood studios are suing Mega Upload for copyright violations. This is the same charge that is essentially in the case that Kim.com, the founder of Mega Upload, is facing in New Zealand. He's getting ready to stand trial over charges of mass copyright infringement. Those major studios are, of course, the major studios, 20th Century Fox, Disney, Paramount, Universal, Columbia, and Warner Brothers. You know, their case is essentially that because Mega Upload would pay people if you reached a certain threshold of downloads, that's evidence that they weren't just a passive provider of a service where users could potentially violate copyright. So that's their case. They were paying users for, you know, to incentivize large number of downloads. Do you think as a sort of consumer and a journalist, Natalie, do you think that that's a persuasive case? Do you think that's a reason to sort of sue the pants off this guy?
Well, I can see why they want to, and they go out of their way to make examples of sites like this. What they're asking for here is $150,000 per infringement, which they're smoking crack if they think they're going to get it. But I can see why they'd want to at least try.
Yeah. And of course, the site was shut down by U.S. regulators in 2012. And this is another case. Another element to this case, which is that, you know, the idea that you accuse a provider of services of something and then confiscate the servers as evidence, and now you have the personal information of millions of users or some large number of users that you can't get, you know, they don't give back, that they're doing who knows what with. Maybe they're doing phishing expeditions or whatever.
Right.
That's another rotten component to this that is being unaddressed by authorities who, of course, would claim that they are above board and everything's just fine, no problem at all. We've got your data and it's none of your business type of an approach. So that's another component of this that I would like to see somebody take on the authorities over personally. This is a case that that's going to take a while to go through the courts. It's a lawsuit. It'll be dragged out for a long, long time. And we'll see where it lands in the end. But this will be a precedent-setting case, which is why it's an important one.
Yeah.
Well, Netflix started streaming 4K TV today. The second season of House of Cards and some nature documentaries are available in 4K or Ultra HD format, and not much else right now. It's also not great 4K. The bit rate is about 15 megabits per second, which should provide a picture that's superior to the HD movies currently available from Netflix, but it's going to be a lot worse than the 4K video you may have seen at Best Buy or something on the demos. There's much better 4K than what Netflix is offering here. And even some Blu-ray movies should look a lot better than this 4K. So it's the early days for 4K, Natalie, and this is a first step. But don't get too excited. And, of course, you need 4K TV to see this stuff.
Not only that, you need a 2014 4K TV. So if you had invested in 2013, it's not compatible.
Yeah. It's not too many people are going to be taking advantage of this. But I do think it's interesting that you see sites like Netflix and even YouTube and even gadget manufacturers like GoPro supporting 4K, and Hollywood is miles away. Hollywood should be all over 4K and really pushing this hard, and they are absolutely not. So this is one of the problems with 4K and the emergence of 4K. It's going to take a long time before you can just flip on the TV and stream 4K movies that are of a super high quality to your television. We're probably years away from that being a mainstream thing that you can do.
But at least there's not a format war here. There's no Blu-ray or HD. You know, there's one protocol. It's just sort of going to be slow and it's going to be painful to roll out no matter what.
Yep. And we also need faster internet. Well, we told you April 3rd about Zunzuneo, a Cuban social network created by the U.S. government. The story was an exclusive by the Associated Press, and they characterized the program as a covert operation designed to undermine the Cuban government and harvest the personal data of Cubans. They also had all kinds of language in there about how the purpose of the U.S. government is to create flash mobs that would protest the government and so on. Well, yesterday, the agency responsible for the program, the U.S. Agency for International Development, responded to the article in a blog post. And they said the AP story was riddled with inaccuracies and false conclusions. And this was, I thought, was a fascinating development. Essentially, my take on this, Natalie, is that this is really a case where either you think that the U.S. government should be meddling in the affairs of despotic governments, or you think that the U.S. should butt out and mind its own business. And if you fall into the latter camp, then this is probably a violation of some sort. And if you fit into the former camp, you might be persuaded by the USAID post. For example, they said that the story, the AP story, said that the program's legality is unclear. And what they said that, in fact, that this program has been the subject of congressional notifications, unclassified briefings, public budget requests, and public hearings. In other words, this was all above board and very much within the mission of USAID. Their perspective is that Cuba is a one-party state that's essentially a dictatorship, run mm-hmm. by Fidel Castro for many years and now his brother, Raul, 45 years. And the people of Cuba have no freedom of information. And USAID was trying to provide a place where Cubans could interact with each other the way the rest of us can. And at the time, only about 5% of the Cuban population had internet access. And this is just a few years ago. Another example is that the article implies that the purpose of the program was to foment smart mobs. And USAID said, in fact, that was just some chatter between the grantee and the contractor within the documentation. There was no intention to actually do that. So it goes on and on. So this is a really interesting perspective. I think that the AP story was coming at it, the whole story, from the perspective of the NSA and Edward Snowden revelations.
Right.
About,
yeah.
And that was that's sort of the mindset. And USAID, I think, is coming from the perspective of the Cold War, which is the grand contest between communism and democracy, and between the U.S. and the Soviet led blocs and all that kind of stuff. So we have two conflicting world views looking at something that is essentially, and I think USAID has a good point, this is essentially the kind of thing that the U.S. government has been doing globally for decades, mm-hmm. Which is that you find a place where there's no freedom of information, you try to secretly provide a way for people within that country to get information and to communicate with the outside world and so on. So it's an interesting thing, but I'm curious to hear your perspective, Natalie, about where you stand on this story. Is this a case of abusiveness by the U.S. government, or is this a case where they're trying to provide freedom to the oppressed Cuban people?
Well, you're going to have to look at it with some kind of suspect, but at least the fact that they're going out in order to clear the record, it's almost more mandatory in the days of Snowden. You can't do things that are sort of underhanded because you're afraid that someone will then feel like Snowden and make it public. So their willingness to clear the record here makes me think that maybe it's a bit more of a above board project.
Yeah. Okay. Well, in another follow-up, we told you recently about Twitter's flirtation with a redesign that would make it look more like Facebook. Well, this morning they announced it, and the examples they show look more like Facebook even than the tests we told you about. They announced, for example, that tweets that get more engagement will be larger. You'll be able to pin tweets to the top of your page, filter tweets, and have other custom viewing options. The new profile setup is available today to what Twitter says is a small group of users, and it'll be rolled out to pretty much everybody over the next few weeks. I think, Natalie, this is dangerous business with Twitter. If they erode the differences between Twitter and Facebook, we don't need Twitter anymore.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. But, you know, there are some, there are plenty of unmet needs within Twitter, and they've seen some slowdown in their new users. So they want to engage them with something that's familiar and maybe a bit more useful. But you're right. Once you start putting your algorithm in there and ranking people according to more importance in their tweets, it takes the agency away from the user, and it's very uncomfortable.
Yeah, absolutely. And in a sec, we're going to have one more follow-up about the Chinese government's approval of Nokia. But first, I want to tell you about Squarespace, the very best place in the whole world to build a website. Squarespace has 25 beautiful templates for you to start with. You simply go in there, choose a template, and then you can modify it to your heart's content. I've been using Squarespace for more than 2 years now, and I absolutely love Squarespace. I've only used the tech support once. I had a question. It was answered immediately by somebody who really knew what they were talking about. They didn't send me off to some knowledge base or something like that. And, of course, their tech support is available 24/7. They also have a site where you can learn, and sort of essentially tutorials, college, if you will, for figuring out how to learn to be better at managing your site. All subscription plan levels on Squarespace now support e-commerce. That means you can collect money for whatever you need to collect money for. For example, nonprofits, cash wedding registries, school fund drives, or if you make something you want to sell it online, Squarespace is the way to do it because it's super easy. And it starts at just $8 a month, and that includes a free domain name if you sign up for a year. The new Squarespace Metric app makes Squarespace mobile ready. And that's for iPhone and iPad. Let you check site stats like page views, unique visitors, and social media followers. And of course, I think the thing that makes Squarespace mobile ready is the fact that when your web page is viewed on a small screen like a phone, no matter what kind of phone it is, it's going to look beautiful. It'll be redesigned essentially on the fly for that small device. So no matter what you do on Squarespace, it's going to look fantastic on a mobile device, which is very, very important these days. So start a free 2-week trial with no credit card required and start building your website. When you decide to sign up for Squarespace, make sure you use the offer code TNT. You'll get 10% off, and you'll also show your support for Tech News Today. And we thank Squarespace for their support of this show. And remember that a better web awaits, and it starts with your new Squarespace website. Well, the Chinese government has approved Microsoft's acquisition of Nokia's mobile phone products and services business, erasing the last credible threat to the $7.2 billion deal. Nokia today repeated its prediction that the deal will close this month. Natalie, I never had any doubt. I knew this would happen, but I think the Chinese government wanted to get some assurances from Microsoft over patents. They're nervous about Microsoft's history of charging a lot for patents, and of course, there are lots and lots and lots of Chinese companies that use Microsoft patents. They use Android, and of course, Microsoft gets paid when certain companies use Android. So this is an interesting interesting development. We'll look for this. The most interesting part, of course, that this could be finalized this month.
Right, but Microsoft's open source now. We talked about this yesterday, right? They give everything away for free.
Yes, they suddenly have become a new Microsoft.
They're arms wide open type. Place.
That's right.
They're not going to do you any harm, China. Don't you worry.
That's right. You can trust Microsoft. Well, that's our show.
That was sarcasm, dear listeners, in case you can't see my face.
If you can't see the brackets. Well, Natalie, I want to thank you once again for coming on. And of course, you'll be here all week. And I really am glad that you're here. I really enjoy it when you're on.
Ditto.
All right. Well, thanks again. You can subscribe to Tech News Today at twit.tv/TNT. And we want to hear from you. Send us an email at tnt@twit.tv or leave us a voicemail by calling 260-TNT-SHOW. Also, don't miss our evening newscast, Tech News Tonight, at 4 p.m. Pacific tonight and every weeknight here on the Twit Network. My name is Mike Elgin. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you tomorrow.